back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So last week, the article that caught my attention, evidently we have more jobs than we have people. That's what we're being sold right now. There's so many jobs out there, so many job openings. There are more than there are people. In fact, what they point out is, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 6.7 million job openings listed. There are only 6.4 million people who are looking for jobs. And again, this is one of those moments where I go, that's fabulous. That means that it should be such a tight labor market that wages should just be shooting through the sky. And yet the same article points out that only 2.7% wage increases over the last year. And you go, but isn't that what we learned in economics class? That, you know, as the supply gets tighter, the supply of workers gets tighter, that the wages to attract them gets bigger. Isn't that what we were told? It doesn't seem to be working. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on just how great the economy is, because we've got a president running around saying it's the best ever. I've asked Pedro da Costa to come talk with us. He's the communication director over at the Economic Policy Institute, our good friends at EPI. Pedro, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
So this is the best the economy gets, Pedro. It doesn't get any better. It's the greatest ever.
It's raging for CEOs. I like the in your intro, the boom for whom. I really like that. I'm going to have to feel that. I really like it. So, yeah, the economy is, you know, by all accounts, as far as headline numbers and, you know, really macro statistics, is doing well. Growth is slowing, but it has been fairly strong. Unemployment, yes, the unemployment rate is at a 50-year low. And then you have that really befuddling statistic that's been annoying me for quite some time that comes out of the very useful JOLTS survey, which is the, jobs turnover, I forget what it stands for, but it basically measures job openings and quits. And the reason why that number that you pointed out is so irritating to me and kind of useless when it gets this low, at the height of the recession, that number was really alarming. It was basically six people looking for work for every job that was available. So that was truly alarming in the sense that it gave you a picture of what was happening. But now this one-to-one ratio, at which we've been for a long time and now we've sort of surpassed it, it tells you nothing about the quality of the jobs and, of course, the type of matching that's going on. So there could be, you know, millions of net jobs available for, you know, hundreds of thousands of PhD candidates, and that really doesn't get you anywhere. So the economy is not doing that well for most people. As you pointed out, that's the main barometer for one's standard of living really is one's income and one's wage, and that has been gradually ticking up recently, but still way too slowly to make up the lost ground of the Great Recession.
Right. So, you know, and I keep arguing there are a number of reasons for that. One, we have a government who will not do anything to help raise wages. We haven't seen a minimum wage increase in, I guess a decade now.
We have a landmark coming up on, I think it's this weekend, but we're going to mark it on Monday, which is actually it's going to be more than 11 years. It's going to be the longest time in history that the federal minimum wage has not been raised since it was instituted. So,
right. I mean, the last time there was a raise, I think it was raised during the end of the Bush era and raised.
That's right.
It took effect during the Obama era.
Right.
The first year of the Obama term. So, you know, again, no one's seen a raise at the bottom for over a decade now. And also you have, you know, an all-out assault on organized labor where, not last year you had the Janus decision that is going to harm workers' ability to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. So all of the things that would help raise wages for people, our Republican friends had done a masterful job of ensuring are not there.
Absolutely. There's been a consistent lack of federal investment. In fact, this economic recovery was marked by economic austerity led by the Republican Congress pushing against any efforts by the Obama administration to stimulate the economy any more than they had originally sought to. They were timid in and of themselves, but, you know, as the recovery progressed, if you look back at the data, this is normally government spending, you know, rises sharply during recessions, as it should. And this time it actually contracted and stayed level and needed to be rising. And so this was a very austere recovery, purposely so, and we were seeing the results. And of course, as you know, this is just a kind of a small chunk of the 40-year period of wage stagnation that we're really looking at that has and is related to all the causes that you cited. So,
right.
But of course, the Great Recession made it a lot worse and more severe and really, really dented workers' bargaining power in a way that I don't think most economists have sort of come to grips with, in the sense of just how much the level playing field shifted in favor of employers in a way that was even greater than before the major slump that we
had. And the fact that we had a government that couldn't respond because, you know, you had a political party, the Republicans, who they would do nothing to help stimulate the economy. There was no stimulus allowed, according to them. But yet, you know, you look at 2017 and the tax scheme that they came up with during what was supposed to be one of the greatest, you know, moments in our economic history. They had a massive stimulus plan to stimulate the CEOs and the corporate boardrooms that has really, I think, has ultimately harmed the working people of this country and is going to harm our ability to answer the next recession that is, a lot of economists are saying, coming soon.
I think it has harmed our ability to, you know, well, it harms the economy in a very direct way, because if you're an economy that's two-thirds reliant on consumer spending, and consumer spending comes primarily from people who are spending, you know, money on things they need, and we don't know about how much more rich people are able to save, then simply by merely depriving people of income and of bargaining power, then you're hurting economic growth. So, and then over the longer run, of course, just kind of erode political power and democratic legitimacy, and it becomes even harder to implement reforms, you might argue, in a highly unequal society. So it just gets harder from there.
Yeah, it's one of these things where, you know, I'm pulling my hair out because I've got, you know, so many, Trumpkins saying, oh, this is a great economy and, you know, everything's doing great. And I'm going, yeah, show me who, you know, show me a working person that's doing great. Most of the people I know are struggling.
Let me give you a couple of personal stories that I can relate to that. The first is that I grew up in Brazil for most of my childhood. I was born in Boston, but my parents are Brazilian, and I spent ages 3 to 13 in Brazil, which, as you know, puts our inequality to shame. In fact, Brazilian inequality levels were compared to, you know, apartheid era South Africa because it's so bad. It's gotten a little bit better in the last couple decades, but it's still horrendous. So I grew up knowing that inequality was a severe, you know, social ill, even for the wealthy and the middle class, because you're dealing with like security threats and it's not a healthy way to live. But I remember in the early 2000s, before the Great Recession, when I was at Reuters and I talked to my colleagues about inequality and how bad it was and how bad it was getting here, you know, they would jokingly call me a socialist leftist, and I would say, you know, and I would give them the same spiel: even if you're a callous rich person, you don't want to live in a highly unequal society. You're going to have security guards and your kids are going to get kidnapped. It's grim. I'm telling you guys. And suddenly, you know, that issue is front and center. And now even Republicans acknowledge it, even if they have, you know, no solutions or even perverse solutions for the issue.
Yeah, if their solutions are the wrong ones. And look, to highlight that, to highlight what you just said, a couple of weeks ago we had talked about the Ray Dalio piece on 60 Minutes where the billionaire came out and said, look, you know, we need to solve income inequality. And he said if he were president, he would declare it a national emergency, because ultimately, and I think, you know, what he kind of alluded to is eventually, you know, it becomes chaotic. There's chaos. And, you know, I've said for a long time, the only time things are going to change is when people like Ray Dalio and the billionaire class fear that their heads could be on platters. So, you know, I think they're seeing that.
I think they are getting closer to it, except I'm glad you bring up Ray Dalio, because I wrote a piece very specifically in response to his call for a sort of for a cleaner, leaner capitalism that would address inequality, basically, because, and I drew on a lot of ECI's research to do that, because you know, Anand Giridharadas has this whole theme about not trusting billionaires with solutions to inequality, right?
No, I don't trust any of them.
And so, basically, I was drawing on that idea that basically he was identifying the correct problem, which is extreme inequality, but he was identifying the wrong causes and solutions. So instead of focusing on the issues that we've been highlighting, like, you know, labor power, organizing, and lack of government interventions and so on, he focused on the old tropes of, like, a skills gap and a technological gap and sort of education gap, sort of these factors that, like, play a role but are not fundamental to the inequality story in a way that it's basically a palliative. So billionaires like to talk about inequality, but, you know, basically if you listen to even in Davos, inequality is a major theme, right? Every major organization is talking about it, but the solutions are very different and they matter a lot.
No, absolutely. So, in fact, you know, if I remember the 60-minute piece right, anyway, he got into some kind of creepy rating system as well, that, you know, evidently there are no secrets and you're not allowed to talk about anything. It was really just this kind of, you know, bizarre world that his employees have to endure. And I'm going, you know, I don't think I want that for everybody else. I don't think I want his world. But the fact that he even brought it up to me, I think was really important, because
I think
he even sees that eventually people like him, you know, eventually the pitch forks could come out, which I thought was going to happen in 2009.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think even he sees that the next one could be really bad.
Yeah, no, who knows when the pitchforks come out and in what form, right? But we also didn't know that the pitchforks were actually going to be tiki torches. So, you know, history can take different turns in ugly ways.
Yeah, and that's, to me, that's the other scary part of this, is that, you know, you look at all of the craziness that's going on with this administration. My fear is not as much Donald Trump as the next crazy person who gets elected. If we get another...
Sure. No, I don't think for me, the fear is not just Donald Trump. It's the fact, and the fear that I think the world feels for the absence of American leadership under Donald Trump is not just Trump's election. I think, you know, I think the world can kind of get its head around sort of having an election outcome that's odd. We have a weird electoral system. There was Russian intervention, etc. I think what the world can't get its head around is the fact that there aren't masses of people on the streets protesting the sort of madness that is this administration, and that he has as solid, even if small, but as solid a base of support as he has in the face of all the atrocities that he's committed across the board and on a policy level, so especially with regards to border policy. So I think that frightens the world, because what it means as far as the U.S. as a reliable partner is that we're always just one election away from another potential Donald Trump, and so I think that frightens the world, as you said, more than Trump himself.
Yeah. Again, my fear is the next guy, because we've, to take off on what you said, we've kind of normalized crazy. I mean, even me, and I spend a lot of time paying attention to this stuff. Even I look at some of the stuff and I go, oh, you know, that's not as bad as yesterday.
I've become
desensitized to a lot of the.
You have to have parameters and pay, and you have to have, you know, you have to prioritize crises, and you can only look at so many things. It really is that, you know.
And you know, the question I keep asking, Pedro, and maybe you have an idea, since you know, where are the Tea Party people? Do you remember, you know, 2010 when they were losing their mind over debt and deficits? Do you remember when, you know, and yet we've got an administration that for consecutive years has borrowed and handed off to the billionaires $1 trillion deficits each of the last 2 years during the best economy, according to them, the best economy we could ever have, which is just insane to me.
Yeah, I think that there was ever any, and this happens, of course, on a cyclical basis, right? The Republicans pretend to care about deficits and just throw them out the window when they're in power. And yet, you know, Democrats sadly kind of play that game and fall into the trap of fiscal tightness when they're in power. But then you get this kind of budgetary move when Trump's in power. I'm not, you know, massively concerned about U.S. deficits, but, you know, it's all about what you're spending the money on.
Exactly. You know, we still don't have an infrastructure plan.
Exactly. We have infrastructure week is every week, of course, as you know, but there's no plan. We just like to call it infrastructure week. There's no infrastructure plan. There's no plan of any sort, really. I like to say that if Trump appears to have a strategy, he's made a mistake, because I think it's really chaos is the strategy, and, you know, it's all about picking up the pieces and figuring out where we can, you know, especially for our work at EPI, it's been about what areas can we our research kind of productive in kind of contributing to the discussion so that when the cloud lifts, so there's room for a creative policy, there's some kind of roadmap, basically, because it doesn't seem to be any room for real progress under this administration.
Yeah, there's nothing in this for average everyday working people, and I think we've seen this. It's about deregulating so corporations can make pollution great, or worker abuse great, or wage theft great, or any of that stuff. And it's about, you know, enriching the handfuls. I can't
see the assault on workers' rights can't be understated. I mean, it can't be overstated, rather. You know, it's been pretty severe, and it's one of those things that, because, as you mentioned, because there's so many flashpoints of chaos, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's the Mueller investigation, whether it's, you know, battles and subpoenas of Congress, you know, these kind of regulatory matters go under the radar, but they're certainly going to come back to bite when the next recession hits or when you have another crisis of some sort. You know, both on the labor side and on the financial regulatory side, you name it, environmental. I mean, the rollbacks have been hard to keep track of because they happen in such kind of ferocious and ad hoc manner. So it's really tough.
No, it's crazy. And, you know, the part of the thing that bothers me is most of the stuff, that really bad stuff, we don't even know about.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, I had one person tell me, you know, imagine, you know, think about all the things that we know, and then imagine all the stuff that we don't know that they're getting away with. That's the thing that bothers me, because we're mired in keeping up with chaos today, or following which insane tweets are misdirecting us one way or another. It's exhausting.
Well, and it's not just that, you know, it's not just chaos is a winning strategy, right? It's kind of that it's easier to be destructive than it is to be constructive, right? So if you really want to wreck things, it's not that hard. It's a lot harder for, you know, the person who's trying to keep it together, if you will.
Right. As my grandfather always said, any idiot can tear down a house. It takes a craftsman to build it. What we're watching is any idiot with a hammer tearing down the house.
Perfectly said. Exactly right. You know, the nice, if, you know, if I can put, it's been a lot of, we've been talking a lot of doom and gloom. If I can, you know, the positive outcome that can come out of this is there's been a lot of kind of rethinking and resetting of minds, and he's opened up the policy space to ideas that were previously out of the realm of possibility, because you know, the debate window was narrower for better or worse. And so I think there's room for, you know, for constructive opposition and constructive alternatives. So that's what encourages me about this kind of dark period.
Yeah, I hope that I hope we pay attention to the debates, and I hope that we toss the bum out of the office. That's the big part of this. It just is what it is. But Pedro, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Great talk with you. I'd love to have you come back and share some more thoughts with us again in the near future.
Anytime. Thanks so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Appreciate it. You know, make sure you check out EPI's website, the Economic Policy Institute. Really good stuff. Pedro DaCosta, Communication Director there at the Economic Policy Institute. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.